to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Welcome to a special edition of Shoot the Defence, brought to you by the FNX Network, My Sportswear and Bites Back Publishing. I'm your host, Stel, and my guest is journalist, comedy writer, radio host of The Late Show on LBC, and author of 67 People I'd Like to Slap, Ian Collins. And this is how it went. Okay, well, Ian, welcome to Shoot the Defence, mate. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to me.
That's a pleasure, Stel. I feel a bit privileged, to be honest, because this is a bit... you've got this kind of... cult kind of following, and it's sort of grown and got bigger and bigger, and there's kind of now as much kudos being on this as being on Graham Norton. That's
wow.
Official.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah,
checks in the post.
I have not been asked to be on Graham Norton, so it's very easy for me to say that.
I was about to say, checks in the post. Great stuff. Well, Ian, the words lightning in a bottle, I often use them when describing your book, 67 People I'd Like to Slap. Now, I knew right away from the first sentence, context is everything, that it will be the perfect read. Now, the book isn't about 67 specific people you'd like to slap, just groups of people. Now, I know it took a year to write. Was it because it was too difficult to decide which group of people to leave out?
Yeah, it was kind of, you're right, it took... In fact, it took a bit long for the original idea of having it, which was the usual thing of, you know, sitting in a pub with a mate and coming up with an idea and thinking, you know, nobody's really written a book about this kind of thing. This was absolutely ages ago. And then since then, lots of people did start bringing out books of just kind of lists of things that really annoy them in life. And so I sort of left it for a little while and thought, no, I'm going to put this by the wayside. It was a good idea, but, you know, Clarkson does this kind of stuff. And despite the fact we had the idea way before any of this, this kind of, it's almost, it's not quite a genre, but there is something about, there is a certain, I suppose, group of people that do write on that kind of, you know, whinge lit, well, I suppose we could call it. I've never used that phrase in my life until that moment, but maybe that's what we should call it, whinge lit. But either way, so it got it sort of just put on the back burner. And then I thought, yeah, maybe I will do this. Spoke to a publisher and then went, yeah, do it. You've got a year. In fact, it was just under a year. And then that realization of, wow, I've got to actually write a book. And I'd obviously written bits and I had loads of notes written down and sort of general ideas. I was thinking back to all the stuff we talked about on the show, and I thought, could I apply some science to this? Because I've got 500 people I'd like to slap, in the nicest sense of the word, you know, obviously in the comedic sense rather than the literal sense.
Yeah.
Well, one or two perhaps, but and I thought, I'll whittle it down, and that became the biggest headache, to be honest, because there were so many, but you know, I could have called it 167 people I'd like to slap, but I wanted to be brutal about it, and I eventually got it down to, yeah, this curious number of 67, for no specific reason.
Oh, fair enough. Well, I know you're a comedy writer, and the book is full of those, as the kids say, FML moments that are actually not funny when they happen to you, but they're actually hilarious to those who can relate, i.e. me. The chapters on adults reading Harry Potter, people that can't stop clapping, over 35s at music festivals were absolutely genius. Which chapter or chapters did you really enjoy sinking your teeth into?
It's funny you say, because you picked a couple of my favourites there. the people who can't stop clapping, I really enjoyed writing that, because I've seen, you know, I think most of us might have experienced the people who clap at the end of a film in a cinema, which is just bonkers. I mean, what's that about? You know, and as I say in the book, you know, the actors aren't actually there.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, they're not behind the screen waiting to come out and go, oh, thank you very much, very nice. Well, that would be quite something to do that in every cinema across the country. But then there's the thing that still happens where people clap the pilot when they land a plane, you know. Landing is not an optional extra.
Yeah.
It's like, as much as Ryanair would probably like to make it an optional extra, it isn't. And for some reason, there is this propensity from some of our fellow humanoids to clap a pilot, which we don't really apply to. We don't do it to bus drivers or anything like that. You don't, you know, have a cab home after a night out, and as the guy drops you off, you suddenly break into a round of applause on the back seat. That would just be also a bit strange. But the one that really got me was the when I was in Italy and I was doing it was a kind of a press weekend for a car manufacturer, and I'd somehow ended up getting invited to this thing, and it was really nice, Tuscany, all of the things you'd imagine. We were only there for about just under 2 days, and they said you've got to go and see the sun setting. If you've not seen the Italian sunset over them, their hills, then you haven't lived. And so we all had a few glasses of naughty red, and off we went to this place, loads of tourists there, and the sunset, and people clapped. They clapped for a sunset. And I thought, why are they clapping for a sunset? It doesn't make any sense. So those three, which I put those three clapping things in under one chapter, people who can't stop clapping. I really enjoyed writing that bit. The Harry Potter one, it's interesting because I had a bit of a debate with the publisher, who said, are you sure it's not a bit dated now? You know, because do adults reading Harry Potter? And again, it was one of those infuriating things that I'd written about. That was one of the first things I wrote. This was before I was commissioned to write the book, but I'd written that a few years ago. And then since then, like Stuart Lee does a really good routine about a similar thing. And I thought, oh, do I put it in there? Is it a bit dated? But of course, since then, we've had a new sort of rebirth of Potter because there's now a stage show. And so adults go to watch that. There's like a spin-off book. There's a spin-off film.
Yeah.
Just this week, Harry celebrated his 20th birthday. So it's kind of as big as ever.
Really. Yeah, that's right.
I feel really strongly about the adults reading Harry Potter. The obvious explanation is why do we not see adults reading Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is another amazing children's book. If you saw an adult reading that on a train, you would give them a funny look and probably move.
Well, I'll tell you what, anything to do with Roald Dahl, send it over here, because I think the film is a genius.
Absolutely right. But we tend not to see adults doing it on a train. For some reason, Harry Potter, which are, after all, when all is said and done, the endeavours of a schoolboy wizard, it involves broomsticks and slugs and fictitious castles and things, is essentially a child's book. But it became a vogue. And I think I have a problem with stuff becoming a kind of a fashion in that respect. You know, it's a bit like when you discover that, I don't know, you know, you discover a really good box set and then you realise everybody's discovered it and you don't have the same kind of thing anymore. It's become a fashion to watch or engross yourself in something rather than a genuine interest. And I sort of feel that, I think, sort of, without sounding too smug about it, the idea that literature, something as, you know, that we respect, and, you know, especially in this country, Shakespeare, with Dickens, we've got, the idea that you pick it up out of a fashion just annoys me a lot. And the Potterettes, as I refer to them, they're not going anywhere still. They're not going anywhere at all. There's still around loads of them. Loads.
It's a shame. I was going to add adults that play Pokemon Go. That's another one that...
That's a beauty. You see, that is another beauty as well. Adults that do that, why would you be doing that?
Yeah.
At what point would you think, I'm a grown person, here's what I'm going to do for my weekend, I'm going to play Pokemon Go? I mean, somebody should really come and either have a word with you, probably arrest you, actually, for crimes of basic idiocy.
Yeah.
It's just deeply suspicious. But then, you see, I had that discussion with somebody about comic books as well, but I've got a couple of mates who are massively into comic books, and that's sort of now been given a bit more of a legitimacy because the whole superhero genre is kind of back again, really, I suppose. But, you know, Spider-Man, I think there's a new Superman coming out at some point. But certainly Spider-Man is big. Funny, I have a friend of mine, just a side issue, a friend of mine is a comedian called Dominic Holland. His son plays Spider-Man in the Hollywood movie.
Oh, wow.
His son got the gig. Dom sent me a text and said, guess what? My boy's got a job in film. He's the new Spider-Man.
Wow.
And if you could ever sort of spy or spot proper pride from a father via a text, there it was. So
fantastic.
He's in this curious position where his son is kind of this good-looking 20-year-old multi-millionaire actor living in his house. It's hilarious.
Absolutely brilliant.
the whole comic thing. So lots of adults reading comic books. I've always been a bit suspicious of that one as well, but it's slightly... That one's slightly... slightly changed a bit, I suppose, but certainly, yeah, Harry Potter, please.
Bit of a strange one there. Well, Ian, you mentioned social media a few times in the book. How have your Twitter followers reacted to it? Because I'm sure there must be a few who read one or two chapters and thought it was actually about them.
Yeah, I was really careful about... I spoke to a couple of mates who write books with, you know, a reasonable amount of success, and I thought, how much do you promote your own book, firstly, on social media without... Because it's very easy to get to... I mean, I think we posted... We made a little promotional video about the book, put it onto Twitter, put it there as a pinned tweet, so it kind of just stays there now.
Mm-hmm.
And on Facebook, I think we've only done two posts promoting the book in the last sort of 4 or 5 weeks, because I just think it would get in people's faces a little bit in that respect. But, however, if other people mention it, that's a completely different thing. And so it's actually been mostly good, but you're right. I mean, just before we did this interview, I've just muted a bozo who has been giving me grief all day on Twitter. And it's that whole thing of people's starting position on Twitter is one of absolute anger and infuriation. How can you be that angry? I don't even know you, mate. But you've begun this conversation by being really, really pissed off. And that just seems weird to me. You know nothing about me. You've made a judgment. You've decided how I vote. You've decided what kind of person I am, what kind of dad I am. All of these things you've managed to, in order just probably to make yourself feel better. And one of the things that I do get a fair bit, and I mentioned it in the book, is this thing called subtweeting, which many people might not be familiar with what subtweeting is. But that's when you kind of include... So, for example, if I... want to say something, if I want to say something bad about Graham Norton, I can tell my own followers that. There's nothing wrong with saying to my followers, just watch Graham Norton, didn't think it was very good, because that's what Twitter is. It's, you know, a conversational kind of chamber for people to have their views. But there should be no reason why I would include Graham Norton in that tweet. That would just be mean and horrible and a bit bullying and suspicious. But people do it all the time. Yeah. People do it all the time. You know, I mean, there was one last night while I was on air, two people were having a conversation who they like on the radio, and they were listening to different people. Somebody wrote, yeah, can't stand Ian Collins. He's, you know, full of self-importance and thinks he's toast. And they could have just said that, and that would have been fine, but they actually put my Twitter tag in, so I received the abuse. And so you don't need to... I'm not bothered. My shoulders are broad enough for it, but why... I think if you said to most of those people, you just realise what you did there. It's like sending a person a text and saying, you're crap. And if somebody did that, you'd be... But I think if you said that to most people, they go, oh, blimey, I didn't really think about that.
Yeah.
And I did pick somebody up on it once who... I mentioned that we had a well-known comedian coming on our show. This is when I worked at TalkSport. We had a comedian coming up, and I said, he's joining us after 11. And somebody tweeted back, oh, so no one funny then. Yeah. And, of course, they also included him in the tweet, subtweeting. And I wrote back, removing him from the tweet, saying, yeah, mate, why did you just essentially text a man telling him how rubbish you think he is? Well, I didn't, you know, and then he got all the... And then when I pointed it out to him, I said, mate, it's pretty... You don't need to do that. It's quite unkind. And he was kind of like, oh, yeah, I suppose it's sorry. Yeah. It just happened before. So I think what happens in with social media, people are kind of temporarily lobotomized. When they go on there, they just... A part of their brain just closes down. The bit that's marked decency and decorum just gets completely removed from their neurological makeup, and they just think it's a wild west thing. Anything goes. And of course, we now know that you've got to be careful with Twitter. First, you can libel someone and get sued for it. You can be abusive racially or homophobic or otherwise and go to jail for it. And of course, you can lose your job for it as well. Right. I forever see people write inappropriate things on social media, and you click on their profile and it says, oh, I'm the head teacher at St. Mary's High School, Beaconsfield. You think, wow, you just said that and you're a head teacher? So I think it's a kind of an area where people's brains in part stop working when they're on it. But so I did, I wrote a bit about that because I found myself at the on the receiving end of a gazillion Beyonce fans after I dared to say something bad about Beyonce, which, again, I didn't put her name into the tweet. But the fact that I even went there, and I don't know how they find this stuff, by the way. How would they find a response? Lord knows. But they did, and they decided that my snuffed out immediately that I was surplus to the gene pool and I had no right to the same oxygen. It was very scary.
Yeah, weirdos. That's a weirdo. Do you know what you should do? You should write a self-help book and then just send them a link to it every time someone sends you a barrage of abuse. Buy my new book as a self-help book. That might help.
That's a good idea. Yeah, I wonder if I could do it. It's a massive genre, isn't it, self-help books?
That's right.
You know, one of the most unexpected phone-ins we did on LBC quite recently was about self-help books. It was we called it our tricky third hour. It's the midnight hour. We tried to do something that's a little bit more kind of thought-provoking, but in a kind of a good excess of, you know, solving the problems of the world kind of thing. And somehow self-help books came up, and it was the most fascinating hour of radio we've done for a long time. It was incredible. You know, everybody had these different ideas of books, but of course, you know, you write a book called I Can Make You Successful. People buy that stuff, buy the bucket load.
That's right. Well, just a couple more quick questions in before I let you go, mate. There are three groups of people I personally can't stand. You've got drivers who don't indicate before they turn, cyclists who insist on riding their bikes on the road despite there being a cycle lane the width of a bus beside them, and people who argue with airport security about liquids, even though there's about a dozen signs which read no liquids above 100 mil. Which of the three irk you most, even though I get the feeling that cyclists would be the one?
That's a really good one, because that's you know, that's not in my book. The cycle one is in the book. I mentioned the cycle lane thing, which is just curious that, you know, down in London, they've built 100 million quid's worth of cycle lanes, and you regularly pass a cyclist who's riding alongside the cycle lane, not in the cycle lane. The cycle lane is designed for him. It's designed so that he doesn't get squashed by a ton of metal called a car. It's been specifically paid for by taxpayers so that he's protected and the environment is nicely looked after, because everyone's obsessed by that in council halls up and down the country. And he's cycling outside the cycle lane. It's nonsensical, but whatever the mindset is of that, nobody seems to have got to. But the thing, the liquid one, that's a good one, because there's an issue with hand luggage, isn't there? Like, if you think, so I had this, I had to go to Belfast to do a TV show there, and I thought, well, it's just Belfast, it's an hour, you know, but I'll just take hand luggage. But obviously, being a man, not, I wouldn't say vain is the right word, Stel, because there's no vanity about this fella here, but I did have a bit of hair gel and some very nice aftershave, lovely bit of scent, and this was removed by the, because it was over the, what's it, 75 mil, isn't it? I think you can take, well, it was 100, anyway, whatever it is. And I thought, hang on, they want to encourage you to take only hand luggage, so I'm not taking as much luggage, but then, of course, you're penalised with what you can actually take through. I've got a feeling that the security at Belfast Airport are the most coiffured and nicely smelling border people anywhere in the land, that they must have so much stuff they confiscated. However, you're absolutely right. Everybody knows the rules. You can't not know the rules, and if you didn't know the rules, you are met with signs all over the place telling you the rules, big plastic bags, put your stuff in here, don't carry this. But you're right, every time you go there, there's always somebody having a row, saying, yeah, but it's only Old Spice. And the guy's going, well, it doesn't matter what it is, it's the amount. You can't take that amount onto a plane. But, of course, you can then buy that amount after you've been through the security, which is a bit weird.
That's right. Well, let's have a quick football chat. I understand you're a casual Chelsea fan. Are you happy with the Conte era so far?
Well, I think you have to. If you look at the result last season, you kind of have to be in that respect. I can't. The kind of Costa Conte thing is the bit that I think most Chelsea fans are going, how does this work? How can you fall out with one of the greatest players on the planet? How could that happen? Only Chelsea. Since I was a kid, this has happened consistently with Chelsea. I guess everyone thinks this about their own team. Curious things happen with Chelsea. They always happen at Stamford Bridge. You know, Chelsea will lose against, you know, Maidstone United 5-0. They do things like that. They do silly things. And Chelsea have had, you know, after the last Mourinho season, of course, which was pretty grim. I mean, he must sit there at Old Trafford and weep at what's going on there. It must hurt him, because I think he's probably still got Chelsea in his heart. But so we stumbled on a manager that actually seemed to turn it around. And I could talk forever about the overstating the role of the manager in these things. I've always thought that we kind of give slightly too much here, but frankly, I've spoken to enough. I remember talking to Ian Wright about this. It's not a name-dropping thing still, but Ian Wright was saying to me, when he was at Arsenal, it would have been George Graham, wouldn't it? So George Graham would give these, you know, dressing room talks, and he said, I just want to go out and play. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. So he said, I never really listen. He'd go, he'd draw these big pictures on board saying, if you can get it from there to there, and you can get to this yard mark, and if you can fire it to him. And I used to think, this is all bollocks. I just want to go out and kick a football. And I can see that Ian Wright. I'd imagine Rooney is probably exactly like that as well. I'd imagine it wouldn't matter tuppence what you said to Wayne Rooney in a dressing room. So the kind of tactical versus, just the natural organic player. But only Chelsea. So Conte, yeah, obviously he's done the business. Didn't quite win the FA Cup, which I like to think is still a trophy worth having, despite the fact that its status has slightly gone down the path. Remember when you were a kid, the FA Cup was big news. Yeah. It was huge. The FA Cup, man. And now, you've got teams not even, they don't even put their reserve bench up for half the matches. So I hope it's coming back, the kudos of it. And then, of course, we find a gifted player in Costa, Conte, and the fallout going on here. And I think, how would that happen? In what reality could that happen? Only at Stamford Bridge could that happen, where you're about to lose one of the most gifted, potentially one of the most gifted players. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, there's a rumour that Lukaku is set to replace Diego Costa. I mean, if that happens, how do you think Chelsea will do next season?
Well, do you hope there's a kind of a like-for-likeness about that? Mm. That's all you can hope for, isn't it? Because, but I worry about this stage. A few years ago when Drogba left Chelsea, and there was that kind of genuine void that was there, a real void, and it was felt not just by supporters who'd clearly watched this gifted player week in, week out, but there was a sort of a certain kind of although I happen to think Drogba was in terms of who I'd like to have a pint with, I'd rather have a pint with Drogba than Costa in that respect, I still felt there was a sort of a gelling that Costa gave the team. And what I worry about is not just the deficit that's left in terms of him physically not being there. It's the kind of destabilisation. Chelsea don't do destabilisation very well at all. They're just rubbish at it. A lot of sides can just somehow get on with it and make it work, and Chelsea just don't do it really well. So, so tactically, skill levels, and all of that, it should be, that we can do just as well here. But I don't know, I just fear this is kind of, we had that gross season, we've had a great season now, and then I just sort of, although I feel it quite exciting, when you get to that point, we think, it's only 8 weeks, the season starts again, it comes around so quickly. But I just have that horrible feeling that Chelsea are going to do what they did. They're going to do a Man United next season if they're not careful.
Yeah, you never know. They might do better than last season. Well, Ian, it's been absolutely great talking to you. I really, really appreciate it. Hopefully you can make another appearance in the near future. Your book, 67 People I'd Like to Slap, is available as a paperback on ebook, and that's directly on the Bite Back Publishing website, isn't it?
Yeah, it's on Bite Back Publishing website, all the usual places. So it's on Kindle or in paperback, so either one.
Great, fantastic. Ian, thank you ever so much for your time, and I hope you have a good evening and a great show again.
Cheers, Del. You too, mate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All the best.